Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. I'm back, but also our co-host, Kate, is back. Glad to see you, Kate. I guess you got away, right? You went away for a week, and I guess it wasn't just a staycation. We don't have to get into where you went, but you actually did go somewhere, which is, you know, in the COVID era.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That doesn't go without saying. So that's great.
Did you feel refreshed? Like COVID does not stop Philadelphians from headed to the Jersey Shore. It's like,
yeah,
that's
like salmon running, you know, yeah, kind of going exactly. back to the original stream. No, totally.
That's instinctual.
Yeah. So we're still dealing with the unfolding COVID epidemic in the United States, and a president who seems to get more and more feral as his reelection prospects become more dubious. And then we have, and we're going to talk about this, these congressional negotiations over whether there will be more COVID relief, extension of unemployment, all these kind of things. And it's Kate has been following this, and it's one of these very weird stories, weird dynamics of a negotiation, because on the one hand, usually Democrats want more aid, more spending, you know, more support for people in financial distress. Republicans want less. But in this case, it's not even clear the Democrats are kind of involved. The Republicans can't figure out themselves what they even want to do. Plus, you have this paradoxical case where if Democrats wanted to be really cynical and political about it, they should like up the stakes and say, okay, $30 billion stimulus is all we'll accept, and have nothing and just let the economy like totally go into a tailspin and take away any remaining hope for President Trump. So it's all a mess in not just in the basic sense that a lot of people are hurting around the country, and as the epidemic has intensified and reopenings that were underway have sort of moved to reclosings, that people's unemployment, you know, it's a mess, but it's a particularly Trumpian kind of mess, because again, the Republicans are, Kate, we're going to get into this, but at least my sense from a distance is Democrats can't even really kind of get into the game, because Republicans themselves can't figure out what they want to do. So it's really all over the place. Before we get any further, let me remind everybody that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. Grady's Cold Brew is here to help you stay cool and caffeinated this summer with their signature New Orleans-style iced coffee. If you're still holed up at home, Grady's can bring the coffee shop to you. Their line of brew-it-yourself bean bags ship directly to your door for less than $1 a cup, and the system couldn't be easier to use. This is true. I have done this many times, and it's seriously easy. Just add water to your pre-measured filter bags for gallons of completely customizable cold brew. No special equipment required, and shipping is free on all Grady's bean bag products. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. And remember, you can get the discount by going to Grady'sColdBrew.com. You can also buy it at Amazon and in your local grocery store, you know, kind of the local place that is open even during a pandemic. So, David, what do we got? What are we doing today?
Yeah, so, Kate, I wanted to check in with you about the negotiations in Congress over additional coronavirus relief. And just to set the scene a little bit for our listeners, just this morning, ADP, which is one of the big payroll processing firms in the country, they have a monthly survey that goes out, kind of which previews the official jobs report that happens the first Friday of the month. I believe the ADP survey this morning showed something like 140,000 jobs added in July, which is drastically slower hiring than we saw in June, I guess, when we had something like 4 million jobs added kind of unexpectedly to the economy, as Josh was mentioning, some of the reopenings started to go into place. But it's been also about a week since the enhanced unemployment benefits expired for millions of Americans. I think there's, 30 plus million people out of work in the country. I mean, it's just each week we get those weekly numbers. It's another 1.5 million. It's even before it was, 5-6 million people in some of those early weeks, if I'm not mistaken. So with all that said, Kate, let us know kind of where do things stand? I mean, Josh did a good job setting it up, but what are the main pressure points or what are the main sticking points that you've been tracking over the last couple of days?
Yeah, so last late afternoon, the main four, which is Pelosi and Schumer for the Democrats, Meadows and Mnuchin for the Republicans, they had their seventh meeting. And the biggest concession that seems to have come out of that is that Democrats have been standing really firm on the $600 a week unemployment insurance benefit, which is what we had before, which is what expired on Friday, because Republicans wouldn't play ball. The House passed a bill to expand those benefits until January, and Republicans refused to even debate it until, the expiration date was upon us. So that's where Democrats have been. Republicans, as Josh alluded to, have been in disarray, in that a lot of them are suddenly deciding to balk at the deficit, so don't want to spend any more money on this situation. So you've got those like hardliners who, McConnell said at least 20 people in the Senate, 20 Republicans in the Senate have said no more money at all. So you've got them. And then you've got some Republicans who are still refusing to go as far as another $600 a week benefit. So there's an idea from or a proposal from Ron Johnson of Wisconsin that would keep it at $200 a week until states could figure out a formula to replace 70% of the unemployed people's wages. You've got a kind of similar but less severe plan from Romney, Collins, and McSally, which would start with $500 a week in August, go down to $400 and $300, and in the meantime, that's supposed to give a little more cushion for states to figure out a formula to replace 80% of the lost wages. And then Lindsey Graham's got a plan. His would cover up to 100% of the lost wages. But, the problem with that is I talked to some economists about it, and they said that the wage replacement idea is not bad in theory. But the problem is there's absolutely no way that states can handle doing these calculations right now. I mean, even their normal unemployment processes are totally backlogged. They can't keep up with that at all. And now to somehow input a new formula to replace a new percentage of wages is just, the delay would be huge. They probably wouldn't be able to do it anyway. And, as one told me, only 16 states have updated their computer systems from the 1970s COBOL framework. So it's just, they just don't have the technology to input that kind of plan. So, it's giving them something they can say, we don't want to do this, we want to do this, but it's not even a possibility.
Okay, when you say on the, come up with formulas to do 70% wage replacement or 80% wage replacement, what about the money? I mean, you can come up with a formula, but there seems to be a major issue that the Congress isn't passing the money to do that kind of, to fund that. So I'm a little unclear on that point. Like, okay, fine. The states come, I guess I just haven't been following this closely enough. Mm-hmm. Okay. You come up with a formula, but again, doesn't Congress need to fund that? And the whole point seems to be they're not willing to.
Right. So I would say some of these formulas are a split of federal and state money. But you're right that in all the Republican proposals, the states are footing most of the bill. And Democrats, as also part of these negotiations, have proposed giving $1 trillion right to states and local governments to help with this. And that's something that at the beginning, Republicans were saying, no, we don't want to give any money. There's still unspent money from the other coronavirus relief bills. And now they, last night, seem to have moved on that a bit and offered anywhere from 150 to 200 billion. So still like far short of what the Democrats are offering. But you know, it's a really key component, because some people I talked to as well about this were telling me how in the recovery from the Great Recession, it was the absolutely decimated state and local governments, which is what took so long for us to get back on track. You know, and they're already, you know, pretty soon we're, the states are going to be at the point where they're going to have to start laying off. They already have laid off people, but start laying off really big numbers of people. And states employ a huge amount, you know. So, yeah, that's one of the most integral parts of this. That there's been some movement, but, you know. And then on the unemployment insurance, last night Republicans agreed to go up to $400 a week until December 15th. So that's the most concession they've given so far. But, you know, in kind of an acknowledgement of the political dynamic, you acknowledge, Josh, Democrats just don't have a reason to budge as much as the Republicans do right now. So, you know, everything I've heard, every public statement Pelosi and Schumer have made have been pretty vague, with the exception of that they're unequivocally saying we're not moving off this $600 a week thing. You know, a quote that Politico got from the meeting they had last night is that Pelosi said, I'm not going to tell single moms we're cutting your benefits in the middle of a pandemic. So,
are you seeing, to look at the politics and who's supporting what on the Republican mm-hmm. side? It seems to me there's, you know, it's become a cliche and sort of a joke that when Republicans are out of power, they get very focused on deficits and spending and austerity and all that kind of stuff. And you see that starting to resurface now. But my sense is, what I would expect is that you have a lot of Republicans. You know, we saw this with Nikki Haley, who, you know, kind of went on Twitter and made a kind of, oh, we got to get, you know, get a handle on spending and the deficits and stuff like that. I would assume that you have a dynamic where people like Nikki Haley can kind of see Trump is probably going to lose. So we're already moving into opposition. So we're all for austerity all of a sudden. And she's not running anything. So, you know, no skin off her back. Mm-hmm. But I would assume that Republicans who are up for reelection, you know, people in the Senate who have to, you know, who are on the ballot in November, they're kind of with Trump. You know, the economy gets worse. It is worse for them. So are you seeing that dynamic where, like, how many of those, to the extent that we know, you know, who those 20 people are in the Senate, are there any of them that are on the ballot in November? Like Joni Ernst, what is she saying?
No, that's an excellent point. And I think the most pressure that we've seen from the Republican caucus is exactly those people you're saying, the people who are up for re-election, generally who are vulnerable in their elections, and who, as of now, are slated to go home pretty soon for an August recess and have to face their constituents. So there has been, from some quarters of the party, the quarters that do have something to lose in November, they've been really pushing to at least say, we've done something, you know. And that's created another tension, because McConnell isn't in the room. You know, he has, to hear Schumer tell it, he's refused to be part of the negotiations. And I think, you know, you can point to some pretty obvious reasons for that, one of which being McConnell's been burned before trying to craft a deal, you know, working in step with the White House. So he doesn't want to make another one to have Trump backtrack and decide he doesn't like it. And then you've also got, he's in a position where, by his own admission, half his caucus is not going to like this deal, is not going to support this deal. I think the ultimate deal we're going to see is going to squeak by with, you know, heavy Democratic support, and then you're going to have Republicans who have to say they did something.
And probably, I mean, again, I would think it's not just a matter of like saying you did something. It's you know, the economy is also already very, very bad. It's a terrible climate for incumbents, but it can get a lot worse.
Right.
So, you know, if you really have no more, you could just have things get much, much worse, and incumbents right. go down in catastrophic economic situations. That's just a given. And again, one of the things that is so interesting to me, again, that for our listeners who maybe didn't see this, Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, was Trump's ambassador
UN
ambassador. went on Twitter a couple days ago and said basically, you know, hey, before this goes any further, we got to focus on deficits, you know, no more spend, all, you know, kind of traditional Republican stuff. And when I saw that, you know, I can speak Republican, even with a decent accent, right? And what she's saying is Trump's going to lose.
Yeah.
This is done. So
you even see that coming into play. I mean, Republicans talking about how the $600 a week enhanced unemployment and, you know, benefit is an incentive against going back to work, right? That, oh, people just want to stay home because they're making more than they would in their jobs. It's like, first of all, you know, maybe we should make it easier for, you know, people who might go back to jobs that are especially risky, whether it's restaurants or, you know, the service sector, like allow them to be safe for a while and be able to, you know, survive on some benefits until things calm down a bit. But, you know, it's just, it doesn't seem like that's tied to reality at all. No one wants to sit around and, like, you know, not go back to your job or not go back to kind of a normal life, you know. But have you picked up on any of that, those kinds of arguments, Kate?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So that is something a lot of the Republicans have been saying. And, you know, you're right from the moral standpoint that there is an argument to be made that people should have the economic freedom not to work a dangerous job, especially when it's currently that danger is a danger to everyone, not just those working the jobs. But even from an economic standpoint, there's tons of research on this argument, and specifically some economists at Yale did a study on this first round of $600 a week benefits and found no discernible slump in employment. So that, I mean, it just doesn't hold water. And the people that I talked to were kind of making the case that this $600 a week right into your pocket is the best way to stimulate this really injured economy, because you want to give people money and you want them to spend it right away. And yep. if the money is going to more people who, let's say the $600 a week means they're making more than they were before this, that means those are very low income people who are making less than the average before. And low income people will spend that money right away because they have to. They don't have the luxury of saving. So just from an economic standpoint, you know, it doesn't make any sense. It's just the classic Republican thing of trying to, you know, it's welfare queens. It's just that in another form of being like, people are lazy, people don't want to work, you know, when really I would think the reaction from finding out that more people who are getting this check were making less than this before should be concerned.
There's something wrong with that. Yeah.
You know, and an acknowledgement that this pandemic is hitting, you know, in huge numbers, people, the lowest income people, that's who it's hurting. That's who it's driving out of jobs, because those people tended to work in industries like retail and hospitality and things that have been decimated by the crisis.
I remember when this, I mean, because there's been a long, you know, a decades long, and in some ways, if you get past, you know, U.S. partisan politics, centuries long debate about this, you know, the, you know, it's basically a moral hazard, our argument that, you know, do you create incentives not to work, or do you, or probably a better way to put it is, you know, do you make people less desperate, right? which at a certain level is a feature, not a bug, right? And when this came up at the beginning of the epidemic, what solved a lot of Republicans was, you know, we got a presidential election coming up. But the other thing was, is like, we want people not to work. That's the whole point. We want people to stay home. So like, are we paying people to stay home? Yes, because we want people to stay home. And as you said, I mean, I'm not familiar with the particular research that you're pointing to that was actually about what happened in the spring. But there have been many studies in recent decades that show that the things that are predictable by a very, how can I put it, a very hypothetical style of macroeconomics that should happen, you know, if you make it, if you pay someone, you know, X to go to their job and X and a half to stay home, logically, we're all logical actors, we stay home. In practice, those things don't actually tend to happen in a lot of cases for a lot of reasons, just because people have lots of motivations beyond purely, you know, rational actor motivations. You know, one thing is that the unemployment insurance is going to run out eventually. So, like, if you give up your job, people know this, and in a lot of ways, people want to. In this gets a very dicey debate. But in many ways, people are invested in their job. So there's a kind of a reflex to, I go back to my job, all this kind of stuff. So I'm not surprised that that those studies came out the way they did. But it's also the case that, and this is why in some ways with the PPP debate, you know, the wage replacement loans that we were doing in the spring, is a lot of this kind of debate about, oh, should these guys have gotten it, those guys have gotten it. You're talking about an economic crisis. You're basically trying to shovel money into the economy. And you should be careful to make sure it goes disproportionately, A, to people who in a basic life sense need it, but also people who will spend it, right? That's no longer the moral argument. It's who will pump it into the economy. But at a certain level, you're just trying to pump money in the economy, and kind of exactly who deserved and didn't deserve it is sort of a secondary thing. But it is fascinating to see how, you know, most political parties, certainly most presidents, know not to force an economic collapse on the eve of your re-election.
Yeah, you know? Correct me if I'm wrong too, but didn't, after the $1,200 stimulus checks went out, I mean, consumer spending did go up a bit, right? I think the people were spending that money, and you know, that's the point basically of why you inject that money into the economy. So
yeah, that's what one person was telling me, how the combination of getting that $1,200 check as well as the $600 a week was enough to keep people at the levels they were before, which is where you want them, you know. But now $1,200 checks have run out, the $600 a week one has run out. I mean, I don't think you have to be super well versed in this to realize people are not going to have enough money to meet their, you know, to pay rent, much less to be getting takeout and ordering clothes and doing the stuff we need to keep the economy afloat. And I mean, to some degree, Josh, what you said, Trump knows this, you know, that's why he and Meadows keeps floating these executive orders, which just don't seem to have that much grounding in reality.
I wanted to ask you about this because I keep seeing they're putting out statements like, oh, we're considering an executive order. And like, you can do a lot of executive orders. You can't spend money based on that is not appropriate. You just can't. That's like a hard stop. So I don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I can't imagine what they're talking about that would, I mean, they can, you know, Trump is still saying he passed that VA Reform Act that became law like 3 years before he became, you can say whatever you want,
right,
it's hard for me to see anything that they can do with an executive order that is going to actually pump money into the economy, which is obviously what he needs. You know, what he says, whatever, but he needs the economy not to fall into, you know, yet a deeper chasm.
Josh, let me just ask you a quick question as an aside. I noticed over the weekend, I think it was on Face the Nation, the chair of the Minneapolis Fed is calling for like a 4 to 6 week strict lockdown and saying if we really kind of hunker down and basically shut down again, like the economy will recover, you know, more robustly. It'll just be better for kind of economic activity altogether. What do you make of that argument? Does that make sense to you? I mean, is that something you think we should consider?
Surprised and happy to hear that. I don't know if it's someone who is, you know, kind of an Obama appointee, and you would not be surprised to hear that, or if it's someone who has a more conservative reputation. You know, for the last 2, 3, 4 weeks, I have been thinking that doesn't seem politically likely, but I have no question that the most cost-effective approach is to do a kind of a draconian lockdown that there are federalism issues, but as much as you can, shut everything down nationwide, or at least in the states that are kind of out of control right now. And yes, it sucks. It would cost a lot more money, but about 6 weeks, which, you know, the number that this person, I guess, said is what I've been thinking. 6 weeks later, you come out on the other side and you can be in a totally different world if you've actually done it right. I mean, I think that, I think that Tony Fauci had a, in one of the member, you know, one of the numerous rogue interviews he's given over the last couple of weeks, said something like, you know, our shutdown was about 50%. In Europe, it was about 95%. And there are some right. kind of wild things you hear. Like in France, there was a period of a few weeks where, you know, you needed like a slip of paper.
I think like, in Italy as well.
Yeah. And I guess it was kind of one of these things where you write your own slip of paper. But, you know, it was pretty intense. We are now in this really, really bad situation where we are both really unhealthy. We both have a bad epidemic, and we're just stalling economically. And in a lot of ways, that thing that we did in the spring, which I can't even remember what the total price tag was, but it was a couple $1 trillion, sort of like was a waste. You know, it really was kind of wasted. And we're not even talking about all the people who died and got sick and had, you know, their own private, you know, personal financial fallout. But like the country took on, again, something like a couple $1 trillion of debt, and we wasted it. And so, yeah, I think that's, we're just in this thing where we're going to constantly have an ongoing epidemic. And constantly having to spend huge, I mean, insane amounts of money. I mean, I'm not a deficit hawk, but, you know, this is a lot of money. This is, you know, there are consequences to this. And it is demonstrably far better to spend now as opposed to have, you know, anemic growth for like a decade, which one of the lessons of the you know, the first financial crisis. I think that is obviously what we have to do. I fear that it is absolutely not going to happen because for all the political reasons that we know, and because of President Trump, and I think given how he has framed his presidency and how the epidemic has gone and all that kind of stuff. For him to say, okay, we're going to shut down again and it's going to be airtight for 6 weeks. I mean, no way. I mean, just no way. He's not going to do that, even though, right, that could get him, you know, late September, kind of like, okay, we're, you know, now we're where Germany is and we can kind of do stuff and schools can reopen. I fear and I suspect what's going to happen is that Trump will lose re-election, and then we're going to have that, what is it, 2.5 months or, you know, 2+ month period where he's going to be acting out and being a complete asshole because he's so upset, and he's certainly not going to lock down, or maybe he'll just like, you know, resign. Who knows what will happen?
Take off early.
Yeah. Who knows? And that that a Biden administration will come in and kind of have to say, all right, we have to do this. We got to, you know, swallow hard and just do this because we are in a situation now where we perpetually have the worst of both worlds. We both have a grave public health crisis and an economic crisis. And you know, I've done a few posts about this over the last couple weeks that I don't, you know, people don't get just how much worse it is in the United States than in other countries like the United States. I mean, it's not like I have to tell people, hey, it's bad. I mean, people know it's bad. They're, you know, they're losing their jobs. They have relatives in the hospital. People have died. But I don't think people get that in the other parts of the world where they have the wealth and the state capacity to operate the way we at least thought we could operate. In relative terms, it's done. You know, I was just, one of the numbers that I've looked at a lot recently is the number of new cases you have in a state or a country or a jurisdiction per 100,000 people per day. Okay? So, number of people per day, new cases per 100,000 people. In most of Europe and Asia right now, that number is under 1. So under 1 person per 100,000 people, new cases per day. In New York, which is kind of the best, you know, as good as it gets in the United States, it's 3 or 4 people a day, kind of bounces back and forth. In all those states, in the Sun Belt and the South, even though they're kind of, you know, they seem to have kind of come off the, you know, come off the peak a bit, it's at least 30 a day. So it's 30 times worse. 30 times worse. You know, so, and you know, Trump had that press conference a few days ago where in that kind of like, you know, sullen, defeated, sweaty kind of affect he has, where he said, you know, now countries that were doing really well, there's new outbreaks, and it just shows it's not my fault, and blah, 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 blah. And they have had these flare-ups. They've kind of had a bit of a jump up in Germany. Hong Kong has had a flare-up, and they've kind of cracked down again. They've had the same thing in Japan. But all of those flare-ups are like between 0.5 per 100,000, like maybe 2 per 100,000. So what they're calling a flare-up is under what our best states are doing. Again, it's like it's over. It's in relative terms, it's like it's done in other parts of the world. And not just a kind of like everybody's in like, you know, kind of in a plastic bag at home with the door locked with like an air tank that they're breathing through. Not only do they not have cases, but their economies are restarting. You know, again, it's so bad that I really think, and I'm not just talking about like some guy with a, you know, MAGA hat down in Texas, kind of everybody doesn't realize how much worse it is here and how if you really do the work, which is not easy work, it really does mean shutting things down for a significant period of time, you can be back to something that is kind of normal. Not totally normal, but people have jobs or doing stuff.
Even in New York, like you're saying, Josh, I think yesterday's numbers, which came out sort of midday today, our positivity rate in New York State was less than 0.9%, 0.86 or 0.8.
Yeah, I haven't, looked at, I saw
but there were still,
momentarily, yeah.
Still 600 some cases in New York State, right? Which, like you're talking about, in Germany, in Hong Kong, you know, 100 cases and people kind of start to freak out and clamp down again. Yeah, so like in our best case scenario, it's still quite a bit higher than international.
Yeah, I mean, I think places. That in, I haven't looked in the last couple of days, but when I looked, you know, 3 or 4 days ago in Germany, I think they had one day that got up to about 500 people. But Germany is four times the population of New York, or a little more than four times. It's I think they have like 83 million people. New York is like 19 million people. So yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of going relatively well in New York, and like it is, you know, four times, five times, six times the cases they have there. And you know, we have this, I think can't remember if we talked about this last week, but we have this debate about, well, is there some sort of limited herd immunity in New York, and especially New York City, because so many people got it. And again, that's not herd immunity when there's 20 or 25% of the population, but it does slow the spread to some extent because a number of people are no longer vectors, all that kind of stuff. Well, they never had that big an outbreak in Germany. But this is across the board that, you know, just it's doable, and we didn't do it. We just made a decision that we were just going to kind of shuffle through. And it's just, I think we're going to be wrestling with what that means for just, you know, for the rest of our lives. It's unreal.
Well, on that uplifting note, I thought we could spend the rest of the episode talking about another happy topic, which is Trump's threats to delay the election and the noise he's making and tantrums he's throwing over, you know, whether the results will be rigged or illegitimate. And this is all part of his campaign against mail-in voting and absentee voting amid the pandemic. Josh, you had a post maybe last week, earlier this week, basically talking about how Trump's threats to delay the election or postpone it or whatever are really amount to kind of present day election interference. It's not just a future tense threat that he's going to try to move the election date. It's just that he's messing with it now, today, in the present tense. Kind of tell us more about sort of that post you wrote or the argument that you were making there.
Well, I think it's a kind of psychological warfare, because I think that a lot of us, certainly his defenders, oh, he's joking. can't take a joke, that whole thing. But even people who are not Trump supporters, I think often look at it as, okay, he said this, but assuming he doesn't, you know, kind of tell the post office not to deliver the votes or, as long as it's just talk, as long as he doesn't do it, kind of, you know, it's annoying, but kind of no harm, no foul. But in fact, he is already working to sabotage the election. It really is a kind of psychological warfare just because of what has happened right now. And I think you can see, we can all see that ourselves if we think about it. Now, look, we pre-Trump, we did not have a perfect voting setup. You know, at TPM, we've been talking about this for like literally almost decades now. Voter suppression, voter ID, all the different things. But at a basic level, in previous elections, we know that even with those imperfections, basically everybody's going to vote. Everybody's going to turn out to vote. We know there are pre-existing issues of some people have harder time voting than others, but we kind of know it as a baseline. And we're all going to work our hardest on both sides, and then we're going to count. And it's not a perfect system, but we know the system, and that's what's going to happen. And we'll see what the result is. And that is kind of what an election is. That's what the buildup to an election is. That's what campaigning is. That's what, if you're an ordinary voter or activist or just a concerned citizen, kind of doing your stuff and volunteering and all this kind of stuff. And that is a big process, and there's a lot of psychological weight to it. There's a lot at stake, all that kind of stuff. And that is kind of what an election is. And now you've got this whole other thing of, can he delay the election? Like, is he going to try to delay the election? Is he going to leave if he loses? He seems to be, and this is not hyperbole anymore. He seems to be actively trying to sabotage the post office to throw, you know, voting by mail into disarray. He has all these kind of lawsuits. So it's this kind of big question, like, are we actually going to have an election in the normal sense? Like, are a lot of people going to vote by mail and then somehow their votes aren't counted because the post office has been so decimated that a lot of them don't get delivered, or he goes to court, or who knows what? It's a distraction, but distraction doesn't quite capture it. He is keeping everyone off balance because he is using the powers of the presidency to create an atmosphere of doubt about whether or not there will be a real election, or whether or not the election will matter. Like, maybe there will be an election, and he'll, you know, one of the things that I have seen people talk about, and I think this is, I don't think this will work, but I think it is entirely possible that they will try, and that is that they've created all this stuff, oh, vote by mail, it's all fraud, it's, you know, all this kind of stuff, that you have a scenario where on the election day vote, the kind of the results you see on election day, maybe Trump's winning, or maybe it's very close. That's not impossible at all. That it could work that way. And then it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and Trump's already said have to have the results on election night. You know, that he has Bill Barr, you know, kind of seeking an emergency injunction with the Supreme Court that the mail-in ballots are there's too much fraud. And my client, you know, Attorney General is not the personal lawyer of the president, but I mean, who are we kidding at this point, right? Donald Trump will be irreparably harmed by counting these votes. And if you remember, in Bush v. Gore, one of the things I was always struck by, if you go back to the Bush v. Gore decision, what was that it was decided, and the Bush argument, the Bush lawyer's argument, was that he will be harmed. Like, candidate George W. Bush will be harmed if you count these votes or do this thing or the other thing. And it always, I mean, let alone sort of the problems with what happened in the conclusion of that election, it always struck me as very odd, as a basic aspect of legal and constitutional reasoning, that the personal interests of this person, George W. Bush, who cares about George W. Bush? Like, voters have, voters have skin in the game. They, I'm at a loss for the moment, what the term, you know, voters have standing. The country has, you know, the system, the Constitution has standing. But this individual guy, George Bush, he has no standing. Like, he's going to be harmed, and therefore we can't, you know, count all the votes. Like, what? Like, that just seems bizarre in itself, let alone how the case was actually, decided. But you can see that as a sort of a logical path for them to go down, because that path has already been cleared 20 years ago. So I think that is a key thing. He is working to sabotage this election. He's making it very hard, almost impossible, for us to have a normal, free, and fair election. Not because of what he may do in 4 months or however long, I'm losing track of time. Not because of what he may do, not because of what we fear he might get away with, but what he's doing right now. He is creating this cloud of uncertainty that puts everyone sort of wrong-foots all his political opponents. And obviously, candidate, you know, you could say whatever you want. At a certain level, politics is about kind of like, you know, mind fucking, pardon the French, of, you know, your opponents and kind of, you know, kind of putting them off guard. But he's using the powers of the state to do it. You know, he can say whatever the hell he wants, but what he is threatening are using his presidential powers. And that's not okay. So I think what is happening right now, just the talk is action. He is already making it very hard for this country to hold a true election. That's a big deal.
And I love that. I love that yesterday he all of a sudden carved out a big exception in his opposition to mail-in voting by saying that, hey, in Florida, it's actually great. So Florida, send in your ballots. It's all good. And of course, that comes after, you know, reporting that Democrats had like a, you know, twice the number of kind of registered, you know, vote by mail kind of applications or absentee ballots. And so it's like, oh, shit, all of a sudden I might be looking at a tough situation in Florida. So go figure, it's all good there.
Well, there's a guy, an election expert at one of the Florida universities, who pointed out, because, you know, it's you don't have to be a Trump creating uncertainty to say that, and we've reported on a lot of this, having everybody suddenly vote by mail is a big deal. You know, a lot of states. They don't necessarily have the capacity. There's issues of there's only so much printing capacity in the country, right? It's a big challenge. But he pointed out that Florida already has a very robust vote by mail system, and the percentage goes up every election. So they are actually Florida is actually one of the states that is in a pretty good position to do this. So you can see this. One of his, you know, maybe whoever's running his Florida campaign is like, dude. Like, shut the fuck up. Like, what are you doing? Right. You know,
yeah.
These things have these, Trump is very canny as a hustler. And that is what he's done his whole life. He hustles. He hustles people. He cons people. And throwing them off their game, putting you, kind of wrong footing you, is what he's really good at. It's funny, during the 2016 election, it may have even have been in 2015, a TPM reader emailed into our talk email address, and this is someone who's in the you know, high level New York real estate world, not one of the titans, but someone who works for one of the titans, you know, in that kind of thing. And he was explaining kind of like, you know, how does Trump get away with this kind of stuff? And what he explained is, you know, Trump does business with kind of like an, you know, ordinary New York real estate guy. You know, Trump gets X. He owes this guy $10 million, doesn't pay it. Other, you know, fellow titan, they grab lunch, and the guy's going to say, hey, you know, you haven't paid me yet. And Trump kind of goes in there you know, he doesn't say, or doesn't try to avoid the conversation, or certainly isn't apologetic. He goes into it. He flips out at the guy, threatens to sue him. And then suddenly the other guy's like settling for pennies on the dollar. And then he's like giving Trump money, right? This is what he does. He hustles people. He scams people. He cons people. And that is what he's doing right now with the whole country. But you can see he's also not, I mean, Trump is not a detail guy, right? So as much as he's conning everybody, he's not necessarily thinking of the second or tertiary order effects of sort of like, wait a second, a lot of my voters are old people, right? And kind of, you know, COVID talks and bullshit walks, right? A lot of these old people, they may be like, oh, with their MAGA hats and everything, but they also don't want to die. So there's a lot of potential for things to, you know, to backfire on him, as I suspect that was what was behind that Florida thing.
Kate, I was going to ask if you think this is all just like going to blow up in Trump's face with, you know, like Josh is saying, Trump's older voters, you know, his base to a large extent, Trump attacking mail-in voting, and all of a sudden, you know, those supporters aren't going to want to wait in a 45-minute, hour and a half or longer line with a bunch of other people in a gymnasium in November when, you know, maybe who knows what the coronavirus situation will be.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most baffling stances he's taken to me, but, you know, as much, I don't know, I haven't understood what he's doing ever since the beginning of Corona when he kind of refused to expand testing, which seemed to be, to me, to be at that time the number one thing he could do to save the economy and, you know, not be dealing with all this going into the election. And the mail-in voting thing, yeah, it's, I mean, it's the same thing to me. You're going to have some people, I guess, who will say, okay, I'll go in person. But as we saw, you know, with that first Tulsa rally, there is a limit to how much people will put their bodies on the line for him. And we've seen it. And that's why he's not holding these big events anymore. So, yeah, I mean, I can't see how it does anything but hurt him. But, you know, like we've been talking about for weeks, he, you know, for all the talk of his 4D chess and such, it's just, I don't know, he seems to just be floundering and not really thinking ahead, and maybe just doesn't have the capacity to connect what this stance means for him. You know, he's just gotten into his head that mail-in voting helps Democrats and therefore it is bad, and that is his position, regardless of the fact that there's not even evidence that mail-in voting is better for Democrats in normal elections. So yeah, I don't know. I don't see how it does anything but hurt him. But, you know, he tweets about it, what, at least once a day. So we don't see it letting up.
I think the one thing that, the one way in which it potentially helps him, although even helps is maybe not the right way to kind of think about it, is that the objective situation for him is really bad. Really bad. I mean, frankly, it's been really bad for him the entire 3.5 years. He's never been popular. He's been consistently unpopular through his entire presidency. I think he was always going to lose. But certainly it has gotten much, much worse in the last 3 or 4 months. He's very unpopular. The economy's bad. Everything's bad. So you play it normal and you're just going to lose. So he does have some interest in creating ongoing uncertainty. Because, again, you play a conventional game and you're just going to lose. If you're a president who has 40% popularity and consistently more than 50% of the population does not approve, and even you got some numbers like, you know, almost 50 or more than 50% of the population strongly disapproves of you, you play it by the book, you're just going to lose. So he does have some interest in continually, you know, throwing the chessboard up and, you know, just... Because uncertainty at least creates outside possibilities that you scramble the deck, right? And so that is the one way that all of this kind of uncertainty and game playing has some logic to it. Not that it has any linear logic to it, but if you are losing, you need to do something besides keep losing. And there's a certain logic to doubling down and tripling down and quadrupling down, because if you're already toast, why not? And kind of like if you lose, you know, kind of the downsides for him are bounded, you can't lose twice. You can't double lose, right? You can only lose. So in some ways, when he's doubling down and tripling down, he's doing it with our chips, right? The things he is doing have long-term negative effects for the country and for tens or hundreds of millions of people. But for him, if he's already losing anyway, why not double down? Again, you can't lose twice, can't lose triple, right? His downsides are bounded, right?
Yeah.
So that's the only way in which I think there's some perverse logic to what he's doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, maybe that's a good time, good place to leave it. And I'm sure we'll have more on this next week and the week after and the week after that. But in the meantime.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
I would like to reintroduce the silver lining segment that we have dropped off on in the past few weeks.
All right, good call. Why don't you kick us off?
Okay. Well, I mean, I just got back from vacation, so that's always silver lining. But as I told the two of you, my boyfriend got a job, which is very exciting and also double exciting
now,
given the bleakness of the landscape.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, and it's a great job and he's very excited. And
yeah, congrats to him. Yeah, that's awesome.
That is a big silver lining.
I can go next. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, but I've been biking around New York City a lot as a lot of us are kind of avoiding public transit and you know, kind of left to our own devices to get around the city. And last weekend I biked to the beach in the Rockaways in Queens, which from my apartment in Brooklyn is about like 15 or 16 miles each way. So it was a pretty serious ride. But I will say jumping into the ocean after biking like 16 miles down to the beach is a pretty great feeling. So that was nice.
Oh, that's so fun.
I will say my older son has been doing a lot of biking with the city bike system in New York City. You know, there's some inherent dangers in cycling in New York City,
yep.
And he's still fairly young, and obviously we've tried to make sure he does all the obvious things. But in a pandemic, you've got to do balancing, right? You know, kind of preteen, teenage boys, you can't keep them in the house nonstop, right? So you need to find things they can do, get outside. And he's been doing a lot of that stuff too. I would say my silver lining is with the kind of semi-perpetual lockdown, I've been able to do some, not just spend more time with my family, but do some kind of life projects with my wife and my kids. And that's what life's about. So those have been very gratifying, and they've been in a sense, if not made possible, furthered by the larger climate of awfulness, right? Because we're not going into our offices, you know, not the collective we necessarily, but at TPM. So yeah, that's my silver
lining. That's great. All right. Yeah, that's nice to hear from everyone.
So remember, the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. Greatest stuff in the world. We all drink it. You can purchase some at gradyscoldbrew.com. If it's your first time ordering, you can get 20% off with the promo code TPM. And you can also order at amazon.com or your local grocery store. And there's, you know, a bunch of, you know, it's funny, we talk about tech, we talk about formats, a lot of different formats of Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can get
the
bean bags, or you can get the sort of the box or the bottle. So it's all good stuff.
All good. All right. Talk to you guys next week.
All right.
Bye.
Later,
thanks,
folks.
Guys.
Bye.